Love right here on VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English on The Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our 30-minute program is designed for people learning English. We speak slowly, using a simple style and a limited vocabulary. Today on the show, Jill Robbins brings us Ask a Teacher. She tells us how to use the words rather, quite, and so. We close the show with our American Stories program. We will hear the Stephen Crane work, The Bride Comes to Yellow Sky. I'll tell you about two new breeds of dogs that have been added to the registry of the American Kennel Club. John Russell tells us about a comic book honoring Betty White, who died recently at the age of 99. But first, we have this report from Dan Novak.
Observers say the trial of former Theranos chief Elizabeth Holmes raises concerns about the way the technology industry pushes its products and services. The closely watched trial has brought a lot of attention to the area in California known as Silicon Valley, a technology industry center, and its methods. Holmes was found guilty on Monday of 4 of 11 charges of fraud. She had been accused of tricking investors into believing that Theranos had developed a revolutionary new medical device. The device, company officials said, was able to find many kinds of diseases from a small amount of blood taken from a person's finger. Now, Holmes could serve 20 years in prison for each charge. Legal experts say she is unlikely to serve that long, however. Few experts expect the jury's guilty decision to change the Silicon Valley way of thinking. The technology industry has long reached success by making big promises. Holmes' trial result will send a message to CEOs that there are consequences in overstepping the bounds, said Ellen Kreitzberg. She is a law professor at Santa Clara University. However, she said, investors are still going to want to make more money on a promising idea. Federal lawyers said during the trial that Holmes was a fraud only concerned with fame and money. Holmes' defense lawyers said she was a very gifted woman operating in an industry controlled by men, who was emotionally and sexually abused by her former lover and business partner, Sonny Balwani. The trial showed the weaknesses of the business method used by some successful Silicon Valley companies, known as fake it till you make it. That idea helped start companies like Google, Netflix, Facebook, and Apple. Holmes founded Theranos in 2003 at the age of 19. She was charged with federal crimes in 2018. During that time, Holmes went from an unknown person to a Silicon Valley star who was valued at $4.5 billion. The story of her fall has been told in documentary movies, books, podcasts, and will soon be a TV series. Holmes set out to create an easier, less painful, and less costly way to look for hundreds of diseases and health problems. Her product took a few drops of blood from a person's finger, unlike traditional blood tests. She aimed to change an industry controlled by testing companies like Quest Diagnostics and LabCorp. Holmes proposed starting with small labs in Walgreens drugstores and Safeway food stores across the U.S. the labs would use a small Theranos device called the Edison to run fast, easy blood tests. The idea, and the way Holmes presented it, excited investors hoping to make money on a new company. Holmes helped Theranos raise more than $900 million from investors like businessman Rupert Murdoch and the Walton family, which owns Walmart. What most people did not know at the time was that Theranos' blood testing technology produced incorrect results. Theranos then secretly sent patients' blood to traditional laboratories using traditional machines. Evidence shown at the trial also showed that Holmes lied about supposed deals that Theranos had reached with the U.S. military and drug companies like Pfizer. The company collapsed after an investigation and reporting from the Wall Street Journal newspaper found dangerous problems in the company's technology. During her trial, Holmes sometimes expressed sadness about the way she had done things. But she said that she had forgotten about some of the important events brought up by government lawyers. She said she never stopped believing that Theranos was going to improve its technology. She blamed Balwani, who she secretly lived with while he was Theranos' chief operating officer from 2009 to 2016. Holmes said that Balwani failed to deal with the laboratory problems that he had promised to fix. She also accused him of abusing her while controlling what she ate, when she slept, and who her friends were. In addition, Holmes said she had been raped by an unidentified person while still studying at Stanford University before starting Theranos. I'm Dan Novak.
A strong Hungarian farm dog and a very small dog linked to the former Russian aristocracy have won recognition by the American Kennel Club. The AKC is a private group that registers dogs as purebred and holds competitions and other events for dog owners. These include the yearly world-famous Westminster Kennel Club show. AKC officials announced this week it was adding the Moody and the Russian Toy to its registry. Moodies are part of a large family of Hungarian sheepdogs, including the Puli and Pumi breeds. Fans say the medium-sized shaggy Moodies are energetic and hardworking and have many skills. They say the dogs can herd sheep, hunt, kill small animals called rodents, and compete in those skills. Kim Sider is a New Jersey dog agility trainer. She owns 4 Moodies. "They're not for the inactive person," Sider said. But she added that the breed is intelligent and trainable. Images of the dogs were used on stamps for mail in their homeland in 2004, along with other Hungarian breeds. The other new AKC breed is the Russian Toy. The AKC says the little dogs should weigh no more than 2.7 kilograms. And have long legs for their size. The group also says the breed is lively in behavior. Russian Toys developed from small English terriers that gained the favor of rich Russian landowners about 400 years ago. AKC official Gina DiNardo said the breed loves being close to its humans, making a wonderful companion for an owner who can be with the dog a great deal. The AKC is the oldest purebred dog registry in the United States. It recognizes 199 breeds. Recognition requirements include having at least 300 dogs of the breed spread in at least 20 states. Many newer and popular mixed breeds, such as Labradoodles and Puggles, are not AKC recognized. Some animal rights supporters dislike dog breeding and the market for purebreds. They say the industry abuses dogs, both purebred and mixed. The AKC says breeding can be done responsibly and helps continue predictable qualities that people look for in dogs.
A new comic book is celebrating the life of actress Betty White. White, who would have turned 100 on January 17th, had a career of more than 80 years and became America's favorite older actress. She died at home last week in her sleep, her agent said. From her early days in television to her famous part on The Golden Girls and her social media fame, the 30-page comic book by Tidal Wave Productions follows White's Hollywood journey. The book will be available both on computers and in print. Tidal Wave Productions has released other biographies, or life stories, of famous people, including Carrie Fisher, Lucille Ball, David Bowie, and Elizabeth Taylor. White won Best Supporting Actress awards for her part on The Mary Tyler Moore Show in 1975 and 1976. She won another Emmy in 1986 for The Golden Girls, a show about four older women living together in Miami. The show explored the issues of an age group rarely shown on American television. White also was nominated for an Emmy six other times for her acting in The Golden Girls. She played the part of Rose Nyland, a kind person from America's Midwest whose husband had died. The Golden Girls ran from 1985 to 1992 and was one of the top-rated television shows of its time. White, who had no children, worked for animal causes. She once turned down a part in the movie As Good As It Gets because of a scene in which a dog was thrown in a waste chute. I'm John Russell.
Hello. This week on Ask a Teacher, we answer a question from a reader. I often confuse the meaning of the words rather, quite, and so. Thank you, dear teacher. Dear reader, the words you asked about are a special kind of adverb called intensifiers. These words make a statement about something a little stronger. Let us look at some examples.
It was rather hot yesterday. That's why I went for a swim. You will look quite attractive in this shirt. We are so excited about going to see the movie.
Note that the words come before an adjective. They give more force to the adjective. It is difficult to say how much force these words add to an adjective because their use can change from one person to another and from one area to another. Speakers of British English use quite and rather differently than speakers of American English. I would like to say a few more words about the adverb so. As an English teacher, it bothered me when I began to hear people using so more often to add force to their statements. As in these examples.
She was so happy. This math homework is so hard.
My traditional grammar guides told me that this kind of statement should include that and another expression, as in these examples.
She was so happy that she jumped up and down. This math homework is so hard that I needed to ask for help.
But last year, my co-worker John Russell wrote about so in Everyday Grammar. He explained that in the past 20 years, its use as an intensifier has increased. Grammar experts at Merriam-Webster Learner's Dictionary still say it is an informal use of the word. What question do you have about American English? Send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Jill Robbins.
From VOA Learning English, this is American Stories. Our story is called The Bride Comes to Yellow Sky. It was written by Stephen Crane. We will listen to the story in two parts. Today, we will hear the first part of the story.
Bride comes to Yellow Sky. The great train was rushing forward, such steady dignity of motion that a glance from the window seemed to simply prove that the flatlands of Texas were pouring toward the east. A newly married pair had come on this train at San Antonio. The man's face was reddened from many days in the wind and sun. His roughened hands were continually moving over his new black clothes in a most nervous manner. From time to time he looked down respectfully at his suit. He sat with a hand on each knee like a man waiting in a shop for a haircut. The glances he gave to other passengers were few and quick. The bride was not pretty, nor was she very young. She wore a dress of blue with many buttons. She continually turned her head to regard some part or other of her dress. It made her feel strange. One could tell that she had cooked and that she expected to cook dutifully. The searching glances of some of the passengers as she had entered the car had brought the blood rushing to her face. Her uncomfortable expression was strange to see upon this plain face, which was usually calm and almost emotionless. They were evidently very happy. "Ever been in a train like this before?" he asked, smiling with delight. "No," she answered. "I never was. It's fine, isn't it?" "Great. After a while we'll go forward to the dining car and get a big dinner. Finest meal in the world. Costs a dollar."
"Oh, it does?" cried the bride. "Dollar? Oh, that's too much for us, isn't it, Jack?"
"Not on this trip, at least," he answered bravely. "We're going to enjoy ourselves." Later he explained to her about the trains. "You see, it's 1,000 miles from one end of Texas to the other. The train runs straight across it and only stops 4 times. He had the pride of an owner. He pointed out to her the beauty of the car they were riding in. And, in truth, her eyes opened wider as she observed the rich sea-green cloth covering the seats, the shining silver and glass, the wood that shone darkly like the surface of a pool of oil. To the minds of the pair, their surroundings repeated the glory of their wedding that morning in San Antonio. This was the spirit of their new life, and the man's face in particular shone with a joy that made him appear foolish to certain passengers. In the minds of some, there was supposed to be something hugely funny in the pair's situation. "We are due in Yellow Sky at 3:42, he said, looking tenderly into her eyes.
"Oh, are we?"
she said, as if she had not been aware of it, to show surprise that her husband's remark was part of her wifely duty. She took from her pocket a little silver watch. As she held it before her and stared at it with a look of attention, the new husband's face shone. "I bought it in San Antonio from a friend of mine," he told her proudly.
"It's 12:17,
she said, looking up at him with a happy expression which, nevertheless, showed a lack of experience in conversing with men. A passenger, observing her small nervousness, laughed to himself. At last they went to the dining car. The man serving their table happened to take pleasure in directing them through their meal. He viewed them with the manner of a fatherly guide, his face shining with kindness. But they did not understand his attentions. As they returned to their seats, they showed in their faces a sense of escape. It was evident that, as the distance from Yellow Sky grew shorter, the husband became more nervous. His red hands were even more noticeable. He was rather absent-minded and far away when the bride leaned forward and spoke to him. As a matter of truth, Jack Potter was beginning to find his deed weighing upon him like a great stone. He, the town policeman of Yellow Sky, was a man known, liked, and feared in his community. He, an important person, had gone to San Antonio to meet a girl he believed he loved. And there he had actually married her without discussing any part of the matter with Yellow Sky. He was now bringing his bride to a sure-to-be-surprised town. Of course, people in Yellow Sky married as it pleased them, but Potter's thoughts of his duty to his friends, or of their idea of his duty, made him feel he was sinful. He was guilty of a great and unusual crime. Face to face with this girl in San Antonio, he had leaped all over the social fences. At San Antonio, he was like a man hidden in the dark. A knife to cut any friendly duty was easy to take in his hand in that distant city. But the hour of Yellow Sky, the hour of daylight, was approaching. He knew very well that his wedding was an important thing to the town. It could only be equaled by the burning of the new hotel. His friends could not forgive him, he felt. And now the train was hurrying him toward a scene of surprise, merriment, and blame. He glanced out of the window again. Yellow Sky had a kind of band which played its horns and drums painfully to the delight of the people. He laughed without heart as he thought of it. If the citizens could dream of his arrival with his bride, they would march the band at the station and accompany them among cheers and laughter to his house. He decided that he would use all methods of speed and cleverness in making the journey from the station to his house. Once safely at home, he would announce the news. Then he would not go among the citizens until they had had time to master their emotions. The bride looked anxiously at him.
"What's worrying you, Jack?"
He laughed. "I'm not worrying, girl. I'm only thinking of Yellow Sky." She understood, and her face turned red again. They shared a sense of slight guilt that developed a finer tenderness. They looked at each other with eyes softly glowing. But Potter often laughed the same nervous laugh. The deep red color upon the bride's face did not lessen.
"We're nearly there," he said.
As the train began to slow, they moved forward in the car. The long line of cars moved into the station of Yellow Sky.
"The train has to get water here," said Potter from a tight throat and face, as one announcing death. Before the train stopped, his eye had searched the station, and he was glad and surprised to see there was no one there except the station master. "Come on, girl," said Potter with a thick voice. As he helped her down, they each laughed in a strained manner. He took her bag and told his wife to hold his arm. As they hurried away, he saw that the station master had turned and was running toward them, waving his arms. Potter laughed, and sighed as he laughed when he realized the first effect of his wedding upon Yellow Sky. He grasped his wife's arm firmly to his side, and they hurried away. The California train was due at Yellow Sky in 21 minutes. There were 6 men in the Weary Gentleman's saloon. One was a salesman who talked a great deal and rapidly. 3 were Texans who did not care to talk at that time, and 2 were Mexican sheep farmers who did not usually talk in the saloon. The saloon keeper's dog lay in front of the door. His head was resting on his feet, and he glanced sleepily here and there with the ready watchfulness of a dog that is sometimes kicked. Across the sandy street were some bright green grass spots, so wonderful in appearance next to the burning sands in the hot sun. At the cooler side of the railroad station, a man without a coat sat in a chair leaned back against the building. He smoked his pipe. The waters of the Rio Grande River circled near the town, and beyond it could be seen great flatlands. Except for the busy salesman and his companions in the saloon, Yellow Sky was sleeping. The salesman leaned easily upon a table and told many tales with the confidence of a storyteller who has found new listeners. He was interrupted by a young man who suddenly appeared in the open door. He cried, "Scratchy Wilson's drunk, and he has started to make trouble." The 2 Mexicans at once put down the glasses and disappeared through the rear door of the saloon. The salesman, not understanding the importance of the warning, jokingly answered, "All right, old man, suppose he has. Come in and have a drink anyhow." But the information had made such an apparent impression upon everyone in the room that the salesman was forced to see its importance. All had become instantly serious. "Well," he said, filled with mystery, "what is this?" His 3 companions started to tell him, but the young man at the door stopped them. "It means, my friend," he answered as he came into the saloon, "that for the next 2 hours this town won't be very healthy." The saloon keeper went to the door and locked it. Reaching out of the window, he pulled in heavy wooden boards which covered the windows and locked there. The salesman was looking from one to another. "What is this anyhow?" he cried. "You don't mean there's going to be a gunfight?"
Come back to American Stories next week for the second half of The Bride Comes to Yellow Sky by Stephen Crane. That's our show. But we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place, with another Learning English program on the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Katie Weaver.